Support comes from Empower Missouri, working to fight poverty and secure basic human needs and equal justice through coalition building and advocacy. Information about involvement at empowermissouri.org/action.
From St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking.
The last couple of sessions, efforts to place the St. Louis Police Department under a state-appointed board have fizzled out. However, this year, it's an inevitability, as legislation placing the department under state control is on its way to Governor Mike Kehoe's desk. On this episode of Politically Speaking, State Senator Stephen Roberts joins the show. Roberts helped negotiate the bill in the Senate, and while he didn't vote for the bill, he said he could understand why some Democrats would, considering what else is in the wide-reaching bill. We discuss that legislation as well as other aspects of this year's session. Let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, the definitive show about Missouri politics.
Let's go back to some of those policies, to that peace and prosperity that we had some 4 to 5 years ago.
Everywhere is Democratic country once this Democrat's been there.
There are a lot of things in Washington that are very bipartisan, including some bills that I've already gotten passed.
And I think it works best when you can see both sides, but you have to pick one, and I firmly align with the Republicans.
But certainly, I think if she's running against one of the crazy dudes, certainly it's going to be a lot easier.
But I'll take wisdom and age and a few missteps in Oralto over somebody who has no substance.
I believe that you represent the party's values and you move forward, and that's what I have done.
And welcome to Politically Speaking. I'm your host, St. Louis Public Radio's State House and Politics reporter, Sarah Kellogg. Joining me via Zoom, he is St. Louis Public Radio's political correspondent,
Jason Rosenbaum.
And sitting across from me, he is the senator from the 5th District in the Missouri Senate,
Steve Roberts.
Thank you for joining us on the show again. It is good to see you. Busy week of news from the week before. We're recording this actually on Monday, March 10th, but let's get right into it, which was the kind of biggest news last week was the advancement of a bill that would place the St. Louis Metropolitan Police Department under a state-appointed board. Why did Democrats decide that filibustering the crime legislation that would reestablish a gubernatorial board to oversee the police department should come to an end?
Right. So it was very clear. I know me and Senator May were really leading the filibuster against that. But, you know, to consider to continue that for, you know, the 2.5 months we have left just wasn't tenable. So, you know, it was important to us that if this was going to go forward, we knew it was one of the governor's main priority, that we got as many concessions as we could for the folks of not only the state of Missouri, but the city of St. Louis as well. And also making sure that local elected officials still have a voice in as far as how these commissioners are accepted.
One of the big changes to the bill is that any nominee would need to get the support of state senators who represent the city of St. Louis. Why was that important to secure?
Absolutely. And honestly, that's what we spent the majority of our time fighting about. As the board was initially proposed by the police unions, it would have them put forward a panel of folks that the governor would then choose from. So the question really proposed to Senator May and myself is either you have no local input or having a seat at the table. So we were steadfast in the point that, you know, if this was going to go forward, the folks had to be residents of the city of St. Louis. They would have to be sponsored by one of the sitting senators representing the city of St. Louis, which effectively gives us veto power over any of the nominees. So that way, the folks, the citizens and residents of St. Louis could still have a voice as far as who's controlling this board, because it's given broad authority. I mean, they're going to be able to hire and fire, select the police chief, and a lot of the inner machinations of how police operations work in the city of St. Louis.
And I know you mentioned this, but I want to be like super clear. So these nominees would have to receive a Senate confirmation vote in order to join the board. Yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. They would have to receive Senate confirmation votes. So in order to really even get to the confirmation hearing, they need to be sponsored by the senator whose district that individual lives in. And, you know, that's not something that's written in statute, but it is a tradition of the Senate and something that has always been respected.
Another change was, and correct me if I'm wrong, an earlier version allowed pretty much if you were a resident or you had a business in St. Louis, you could serve on the board. It's now just resident, correct? You took the business part out of it?
We did. There was a compromise made on it, though. So there would be a 6-member, an ex officio member, but they wouldn't have the authority to vote on the matters before the board. So you could have someone who has a business but does not actually reside in the city of St. Louis as part of the board. But again, they would be a non-voting member.
This may be a semantical question, but I'm going to ask it anyways. The 4th District includes a significant portion of St. Louis County, and it's not out of the realm of possibility that sometime in the future, perhaps even in 2027, that someone who lives in St. Louis County could represent the 4th District. Do you have any concerns about somebody who doesn't live in the city of St. Louis could effectively have veto power over the membership of this gubernatorial board?
I don't. You know, I think just the history of how the 4th and 5th districts have operated together. I mean, Senator May is one of my closest friends and allies up here, and they're still responsible for representing those parts of the city and county as well. So, you know, you could have a situation, I suppose, where the two senators don't get along, but I mean, they still represent the city of St. Louis. Those are still their constituents.
I want to just ask from a more practical standpoint. St. Louis Democrats have almost been universally opposed to having a gubernatorial board oversee the St. Louis Metropolitan Police Department. I say almost universally opposed because there are some supporters. State Representative Steve Butts, I believe, backs that arrangement. Why do you think the current setup, where the mayor's office essentially oversees the city's law enforcement agency, is better than having a gubernatorial board?
So however you may feel about an individual mayor and their policies, I think just in principle, you want local control and you want that delegated down to the lowest level. You know, I think that's important in policy and principle. So by doing this, you are ceding some of that authority to the governor because they're still considered, you know, a gubernatorial appointee, and he's really or that individual is really having a lot more influence than they do under the current system.
I ask this question because it is somewhat unusual for a mayoral administration to have direct oversight over a police department in the St. Louis region. Most police departments in St. Louis County answer to city managers. The St. Louis County executive doesn't have direct control of the St. Louis County Police Department. There's a board of police commissioners that they appoint.
Mm-hmm.
Why should the city have such a radically different setup than those arrangements that I mentioned? And I use the word radically purposefully because that there's a big difference between an elected mayor overseeing a police department and a city manager or a board overseeing a police department.
Right. I think that just goes to kind of the unique situation of the city of St. Louis and its makeup. I mean, I think it's important to have more of that centralized authority when you're dealing with the police force for our city and region. I wasn't elected at that time when that went into effect back in 2012, but, you know, I think it was seen as a more efficient and more effective way, hopefully, to run the department.
You know, as I said earlier, we're recording this show on Monday, March 10th, and the Senate is actually slated to vote on this bill today, according to floor leader Tony Lueckdemeyer. You mentioned that you wouldn't be surprised if some Democrats voted for this bill. Why?
You know, if the state control part of this legislation wasn't in the bill, I'd be voting for it. I mean, we have been working tirelessly to get things that we just have failed to make it across the finish line in previous years. And with it being attached to this bill, that is the governor's priority. You know, in the state, he can't just line item veto out parts of it that he may not agree with. And so I think that goes to the importance of compromise. I know the previous administration had vetoed legislation that we actually got to the finish line that was focused on folks who have been wrongfully convicted of crimes, getting restitution for them, but also different programming as far as tuition assistance and things like that. You know, we've heard horror stories of women being shackled in prisons, inmates being victim of price gouging when they're trying to make phone calls to stay in touch with their families. And it's been proven that if they're able to kind of maintain that support network, they're far less likely to commit more crimes in the future. Just being able to maintain that support system. So, you know, this and other pieces of legislation are why, you know, I think Democrats could in good faith vote for this bill. I mean, there are a lot of Democrat priorities in this legislation.
Something that's also not in the bill anymore was language on the definition of rioting. It would have expanded what rioting means. One, if you want to like tell our listeners kind of what that did and why it's no longer, why that was a Democratic decision to get that out.
Absolutely. And I got to give credit to our minority floor leader, Senator Doug Beck. He worked really hard on this part to make sure we remove the part dealing with, you know, how they define rioting. We're really targeted and focused on, you know, folks who are peacefully protesting, and the potential for that statute to be abused. So as one of the compromises, that part was has been pulled out. There was a enhancement part in it, but also just removing part of that entire section that's currently in state law.
So moving on to last week's press conference. So during the Democratic press conference, you had some harsh words for St. Louis Mayor Tatara Jones, and you said the passage of this bill signaled a deterioration of her influence among GOP legislators. Why do you feel this way?
I'd say Democrat legislators as well. And, you know, one of the most interesting things that I have not seen in my political career is having the Ethical Society of Police and the police St. Louis Police Officers Association both lockstep as far as the need to change how the board was run. I mean, I think that when this was first put into effect, they were each supportive of it, but the conditions have just deteriorated so bad that they have no confidence in the administration. I mean, the issues that I've heard from them about simple things from like paychecks to getting their vehicles replaced and the parts they need, it has just been met with obstacle after obstacle after obstacle. And, you know, hearing from them, it made it very clear that something needed to be done. I think as we saw as the votes from the election on last Tuesday, the citizens of the city of St. Louis are fed up and they're ready for a change.
Senator Nick Schroer has said that this bill isn't necessarily an indictment on Mayor Jones because it's been filed when Lyda Crewson was mayor. So I guess thoughts on that it wasn't strictly because of that, but maybe why there might be a more intensity of getting it passed in the last few years.
Yeah, so I've seen that pass, you know, offered several times, but never this much energy and effort and political capital used to get done. I mean, for the governor, basically, this is one of my priorities. The way it's been fast-tracked, I mean, we go for spring break next week. It's done before then, so there's a good chance that it could be signed into law later this week. I think the deteriorating conditions have caused it to escalate to them realizing, all right, we need to fix this, and we need to fix it now.
I guess just to follow up on Sarah's point, though, Governor Mike Kehoe made putting a gubernatorial board in charge of the police department like one of the number one priorities of his administration. So couldn't it stand to reason that regardless if the mayor was Tashara Jones, Kira Spencer, Lyda Crewson, Francis Slay, Freeman Bosley Jr., nothing could have prevented the legislature from passing this bill?
I disagree. I think that if you had a police force that was supported by their mayor, and if you had the St. Louis Police Association, if you had the Ethical Society of Police telling Governor Kehoe, hey, look, things are working, or we're about to have a new administration come in, don't pass this legislation, it would have died on the vine.
Jones's office has pushed back at your characterization that she didn't do enough to stop the state control bill. She pointed out that she's testified against the legislation in the House and Senate and worked with your colleague, Senator Carla May, to oppose the measure. Are you mischaracterizing the way she tried to stop this legislation?
Absolutely not. I mean, coming up for a photo op to testify on a bill is not advocacy. It's sufficient advocacy. I mean, it's speaking with the bill sponsor. If someone is carrying a piece of legislation that, you know, I think impacts the city of St. Louis, I'm not just going to talk to Carla about it, Senator May about it. I'm going to talk to the Republicans who are leading it or are pushing this legislation, try to convince and explain to them why this is a problem. And we just didn't see that here in the Capitol at all.
Jones's spokesman, Connor Kerrigan, went on to say, quote, "The senator is using the mayor as a convenient political punching bag to distract from the fact that he has not been at the table and is unwilling to stand up for the city of St. Louis in any meaningful way. Good luck to him on whatever appointment he is currently seeking from Governor Kehoe." What do you have to say to that?
I mean, that's just hilarious. I mean, I was clearly leading the filibuster on this piece of legislation, and all of the majority of the changes that we were able to put in there was a team effort between me and Senator Carla May. So I think that, you know, you want to talk about alternate universes. It's just completely absurd to say that we weren't doing everything we could to make this bill as least harmful, but also bringing back some amazing things for the district as well.
Jones came in a very distant second to Alderwoman Kara Spencer last week in the mayoral primary. And if Spencer wins on April 8th, do you have confidence she'll be able to deal with the GOP-controlled legislature more effectively, especially since she's never identified as a conservative or moderate at any point in her political career? And as you know, the Republican-led legislature is pretty darn conservative on a lot of issues.
Right. No, I do. And I think it's an opportunity for a new beginning. I mean, as we've seen the success of our new circuit attorney who is recently reelected. Gabe Gore is doing a fantastic job, has developed a relationship with folks on both sides of the aisle, on the legislative and executive branches. You know, I wouldn't expect anything less from our Alderwoman Kara Spencer and this new role. And I think Republicans, well, I know this from speaking to them, they want her to be successful. They want to have an effective police department. And, you know, I've had conversations with my colleagues on the other side of the aisle, and one of these questions even came up at the press conference. You know, what about, you know, some state funding from general revenue to kind of help during these transition periods? And all of my conversations, my friends and colleagues from the other side of the aisle have been very open to it. So I think this is, you know, unfortunately, you know, I'm against losing this local control, but it's a real opportunity for our local level, our local elected officials to have a positive relationship with our state leaders.
You're pretty well versed in St. Louis politics, particularly North St. Louis politics, as your family has been involved in it in one form or another for many decades. And one of the striking things about Tuesday's results is Spencer ended up doing historically well in some African-American wards. For context, in the 2021 primary, she got between like 10 to 20% of the vote in Black majority wards against Jones and Lewis Reed, who are both African-American. This time, in a race with three African-American candidates, she ended up anywhere from in the 30 to 40 percentile range in those wards. Given like the history of racial polarization in city voting, why do you think Spencer was able to get fairly significant African-American support in this race?
Well, I think, I mean, you've heard the criticisms for me as far as the mayor's relationship with the police department, but that just has trickled down to all levels of government between that and the Board of Aldermen. I mean, this snowstorm, for example, like the absurdity of the just sitting there for weeks and basically like taking no responsibility or accountability for it. You know, trash, the potholes, just things that everybody is seeing on a daily basis that the mayor's office has failed to act on. I mean, you take, you know, just one other just level that is just completely baffling is when you're looking at, for example, the Rams money that had just sat without being in an interest-bearing account for, I believe it was 7 months. It's just the list goes on and on and on of ineptitude within that administration. And voters are tired. I mean, my constituency, I can tell you, is fed up. And that's why I think you saw, like, as you mentioned, Jason in North St. Louis, folks want to change.
You demurred from giving an endorsement last week in the press conference. Are you willing to do an endorsement now on the mayoral race?
You know, I typically avoid making those types of endorsements or engaging in any kind of political activity while we're in the Capitol.
We need to take a quick break, but we'll be right back.
The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.
And we're back on Politically Speaking. Our guest in this episode is Senator Stephen Roberts, who is the senator from the 5th District representing St. Louis. Let's just go into the overall Senate as a whole. It seems that from the outside looking in, one look at it is that some Democrats might be having a harder time combating legislation that they don't like from Senate Republicans. What do you think of this observation?
You know, I mean, the Democratic Party, the 10 of us, we're united. We make an amazing team. I'm very impressed with our freshman senators. And, I mean, you're seeing the Senate function in a very different way from last year. I mean, we're moving at a quicker pace than the House. And if you look at the legislation that we've been moving through, yeah, it's been slow and steady. But for the most part, these bills have had bipartisan support.
Even to go briefly back to the public safety bill with state control, Senator Schroer thanked you and Senator May on like kind of the negotiations. So even if it's legislation that maybe Democrats don't vote for, do you think there's been kind of a more cohesiveness as far as negotiating?
Absolutely. And willing to find compromise. I mean, that shouldn't be a bad word. I think a lot of that goes to, you know, me and Senator Schroer, Senator May, a lot of the folks in there now, we've served in this body together as for almost a decade now. So just kind of building on those relationships and knowing, you know, it's interesting how each session is different from the next. And I think folks, everyone on both sides of the aisle, because everyone's up here elected, you know, to to make Missouri a better place for everyone. And deep down, I believe all of my colleagues feel like that's what they're trying to do. We may just have different ways of as far as going about that. So I think this session, you're kind of just seeing, you know, everyone try to get along, which really should be the norm, especially the way you hear, you know, the hostility at the national level. So being able to find compromise and work together where you can has been vitally important.
As you said, the building is very different than it was a year ago. You know, Republicans have seemed to smooth out some of the fissures within, you know, Republican leadership, as well as the four members of the Freedom Caucus who, you know, last year would have been seen as kind of troublemakers. Do you think that that's one of the reasons why things have just been moving better and why Democrats have had to maybe kind of be a little bit more on defense when it comes to negotiations?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, we're always on defense. I mean, when you're in a super minority position as we are now, and that's kind of one of the things as well. Someone once told me, reporters don't write stories about planes that land, but a lot of it is legislation, harmful legislation that we are able to stop and prevent from getting to the finish line. Or, you know, a lot of folks might see this bill, but they don't realize what it actually looked like at first when we were adamantly against it. You know, they remember at the beginning of the session, you know, there were conversations as far as, well, you know, are they just going to force us through? What's going to happen? And, you know, the real work is done with that final product that we have. And it's a final product that, you know, as I said, I'm against it, but I could see why some of my colleagues would vote for it, because there are a lot of good things that are going to make a huge impact to citizens all across Missouri.
You mentioned that your caucus was united, and I assume on the issue we're going to talk about next, they're united, but it hasn't been always the case. Like, I noticed on Senate Bill 4, which is a major utilities bill, that there was this odd coalition of no votes, where there were some conservative Republicans voting with some Democrats, but some Democrats like yourself, Senator Weber, Senator Washington, Senator May, all voted for it. Is it just going to be an issue by issue situation in terms of like where your caucus goes on something like that, you know, is going to pass, and you may have more free rein to vote on it than, say, the local control bill or the state control bill?
Not necessarily. And again, with the utility legislation, it really became the culmination of four utility bills coming together and merging it as this omnibus piece of legislation that was going forward. And I know for some folks, had issues with Senate Bill 4 versus 5 versus 6, and they kind of put all of those together. So that's another one where a lot of compromises needed to be made. I worked very closely actually with Senator McCreary on that with the final bill that came through. And we had representatives from the Public Service Commission, the Office of Public Counsel, to make sure that, you know, these utility monopolies are still governed effectively. So I think the reason why with the piece of legislation like that, that is so massive, it's not a one issue bill. You can find things you like about it, and you can find things you don't. And I think that on some issues like that, I can understand why a senator would vote for or against it.
So speaking of unity, a reason I think Jason is bringing this up is that there's a big push from Republicans to place something on the 2026 ballot to undo Amendment 3, which was the measure that enshrined abortion rights in the Constitution. Do you think Senate Democrats will be able to filibuster that into oblivion, or is it inevitable that something will make it onto the ballot?
You know, the way I've seen it, I think that even within the Republican Party themselves, there are differing opinions on what a woman's right to choose should look like. I mean, you've got, I think, some folks who are pro-choice, some folks who think, look, you know, we need to have certain exceptions for situations of rape and incest, and some folks who believe, you know, up to a certain point. And then there are members who believe that in no circumstance is abortion acceptable, no matter how horrible the situation. So I think that, yeah, you're going to see a lot of pushback from Democrats, but also Republicans as well, who are not going to fit into each of those categories.
That was leading to my next question. Do you feel like Republicans even have a plan right now that's united, that would both get, you know, satisfy the more conservative Republicans versus more moderate, also getting something that would be passed by Missouri voters?
Absolutely. And that's a fantastic question. And I don't know. I don't caucus with them, but I could imagine that these are the debates that they're having amongst themselves. You know, where can we find the compromise within our party that, you know, makes everybody happy? But unfortunately, in this building, that's something very difficult to do.
Are you confident that voters will reject any anti-Amendment 3 measure? You know, there could be an idea from Republicans that they think they could get it passed, especially if they include a constitutional ban on gender-affirming care for minors.
You know, voters are smart, and I think that they would recognize it for what it was. You know, there was an argument that they really didn't understand what they were voting for, and I think they knew exactly what they were voting for, that amendment thing was the right thing to do for the state of Missouri. So, you know, we saw them try to kind of something similar, you know, with what we call ballot candy with the initiative petition process, putting in things that are already law, for example, that, you know, folks who aren't citizens can't vote in the state of Missouri, which is already in place. So, you know, to try to add that aspect, as you were talking about with gender affirming care, you know, we were able to strip those other ballot candy pieces out of the legislation. So, you know, and we were confident that they needed that for their version to pass.
What are other possible bills or proposed amendments that your caucus would like to try and stop before session ends in May?
You know, a lot of times, just being in the supermajority, we're in a defensive position. So it's really going to be kind of determined by the Republican leadership. So it's hard to say at this time. You know, we're about to go on our spring break. I'm really curious to see what, you know, is tried to push through this week. I think it'll be an exciting week in the Senate, but it's hard to say right now.
Now, before you go, because the clock is ticking before a Senate comes back, I do want to talk about a couple bills that you have sponsored. Two that you've introduced would allow the city of St. Louis to impose a property tax or sales tax for special education related purposes. Could you talk about that and what prompted you to put that forward?
Yeah, you know, just from speaking from local community leaders, you know, a lack of resources for folks. So that's really kind of what was the inspiration for that piece of legislation. And you know, one of the biggest challenges I'm finding is that, especially for new families, is they want their kids. I mean, I'm a new uncle. I got two new nieces and nephews, and just looking at my siblings, you know, determining, you know, where they want to live if they're going to move was the school systems, and making sure that, you know, our schools have the right tools and opportunities that you know their children will need. So it's really about just trying to give them more support.
And full disclosure, people who listen to the show know, I left the city of St. Louis because one of my sons has a developmental disability. I could go on for hours about this topic, but I'm going to try to keep it brief. I actually talked with SLPS St. Louis board members Tony Cousins and Matt Davis about this topic, and the reason why I think this may be needed is SLPS is at a competitive disadvantage in getting staff compared to the special school district in St. Louis County. Special school district is like a property tax that all the county residents pay hundreds of millions of dollars. They can't possibly compete.
Right.
Do you think something like this could help close that gap that I just talked about?
I do. And Jason, unfortunately, that story is not an uncommon one. So it's an issue that absolutely needs to be addressed. And it's something that I'm trying to fix here in the Senate.
Another bill of interest you put forward is boosting admission fees to enter casinos. What was behind this legislation and why do you think it's needed?
Great question. So I actually serve on the Missouri Veterans Commission that's responsible for our veterans' homes and cemeteries across the state. And part of how they get their funding is from the Gaming Commission. So anytime that someone enters the floor of a casino, the $2 admission fee needs to be paid into this fund. Well, after COVID, we found that, you know, folks just weren't going to casinos and they weren't generating that revenue forward. So actually in the governor's state of the state address, he'd mentioned making sure that we had funding to make sure a veterans home in Lawrence County was able to stay open, because the commission has been having to make some very difficult decisions because they're just not receiving the funding through these mechanisms as they normally had. So that $2 admission amount was set over three decades ago in 1990 and has not moved up or accounted for inflation at all. So this would double it, and then we put in a caveat to to increase along with inflation. So it's not a situation where I'm going to have to come back every, you know, five, 10 years to try to increase that amount. I mean, it's fair, it's the right thing to do, and it's something that our veterans' homes absolutely need.
So we have seen how persnickety casinos can be when they feel that their revenue streams are threatened. Just ask Denny Hoskins' efforts to try and legalize video lottery terminals. What have been the casinos' reactions to this? And are they not for it because they would have to be giving more money to the state? Or is this such a small amount of money for them that they don't really care about this if it goes from $2 to $4, or and then inflation,
right?
I would
say they care. Last session with Senator Hoskins, we were able to kind of get this on as amendment and some other things dealing like with the sports betting to shore up and help you make sure that these veterans' homes have the funding that we need. And that's something that we actually got, it got onto the bill with bipartisan support. So, you know, I from the experiences that I've had, they've, you know, opposed it. But, you know, I'm more than willing to sit down and work with them and try to find a solution to this problem, because it's not right that our veterans' homes aren't getting the funding they need. I mean, these are folks who've served their country. They're entitled to this right. And the idea that our state is considering having to shut some of these down is just untenable. So I think on this issue, it reaches across party lines. And I, you know, would welcome a conversation that I do with, you know, anyone who opposes something that I work on, and hope that, you know, we can come to a solution.
Are there any other bills that you think have a good chance of making it to Governor Kehoe's desk this session?
Yeah, so a priority of mine that I've been working on with Greater STL, local elected officials and community leaders is the Downtown Revitalization Act, Senate Bill 35. And what this does is it creates a tax credit for converting residential commercial spaces and main streets into residential housing. So, you know, you've got the AT&T building, 1.4 million square feet, that's been sitting vacant for decades, the Railway Exchange, and, you know, only about 5,500 folks live downtown. And more so than that, I mean, the city of St. Louis is a city built with a population 4 million. So, you know, our downtown is just such a gem. And if we're able to get more folks living down there, more foot traffic, it's more likely that crime will go down and we can really see a revitalization of our downtown and main streets. And it was important that we got buy-in from our colleagues across the state and a lot of their historical districts. You know, they've got these first four retail spaces, but the upstairs residential parts, you know, from the first floor up are dilapidated or falling apart. So this is something that we've been working on over the past 2 years, and we've got it to a really good place. And I think it's going to make a huge difference all across the state of Missouri. And, you know, one of the caveats to this is, you know, folks, they actually have to own this building. So for every $4 in, they're getting a credit for one back. So, I mean, they've already put the funds in, and then they would be issued. They have to apply and be issued the credit, you know, afterwards. So I think it's more than fair. And like with the larger buildings, I mean, it's the point where they're just too expensive to tear down and they just sit there. So this is a way to solve that problem of vacant buildings, you know, for me in the city of St. Louis, but also across the state of Missouri.
And that's all the time we have. Thank you so much, Senator Roberts, for joining us on the show. Politically Speaking is a product of St. Louis Public Radio, which is owned by the University of Missouri, St. Louis. You can find all of our coverage, politics and not, at stlpr.org. And Senator Roberts, where can people find you on the internet where you want to be found?
All right. So the best way to contact me or reach me is our website. That's senate.mo.gov/Roberts. You can find our contact information. You can give us a call, 573-751-4415. Yeah, I got to say, some of my best ideas come from constituents. So if there's an issue or problem that you all experience that we can do something at the state level, I'd love to get involved.
All right. Thank you so much. And until next time, so long. Politically Speaking is produced by Jason Rosenbaum, Rachel Lippman, and me, Sarah Kellogg. The show is edited by Fred Ehrlich. Read all of our coverage at stlpr.org. And if you haven't already, make sure to subscribe to Politically Speaking by searching the term Politically Speaking on Apple Podcasts.
If you have a smart speaker, you have access to the entire world of NPR and St. Louis Public Radio. All the latest news and all the captivating stories. Activate our voices with yours by telling your smart speaker to play St. Louis Public Radio.